I grew up as a comic book junkie. I think that came from being miserable in Vermont, from being a maladjusted child. He also admitted that his desire to make comics about vigilantes like Daredevil and Batman stemmed from his own frustrations with living in New York City in the early 1980s. That said, he took pains to distinguish those impulses from reality, confessing, "The one time where I actually got punched in the mouth hard was one of the ugliest experiences in my life. It certainly generated the ugliest emotion I've ever had." For my own part, while my childhood was far from miserable, I was never very popular, and most of my friends were make-believe. I'll freely admit that one of the reasons why I fell in love with Star Trek The Next Generation and Uncanny X-Men was because they provided me with a solace from grade school and high school, places I disliked. Star Trek was more than just a TV show, X-Men more than just a comic. They were my means of dreaming of a better life, and I invested a great deal of myself in them from the age of 10 through 18. But wasn't that exactly what the movies were for a young, asthmatic Martin Scorsese, who obsessively rewatched the films of Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger? Wasn't that what bodybuilding was for Arnold Schwarzenegger, whose father abused him, and who dreamed of moving to America to become like his idol, Steve Reeves? Escapism comes in many forms, being a means of coping with alienation, dissatisfaction with the current state of things. And in escapism can be found the motivation to change one's life. One of the reasons why I went away to college was because I was enamored with X-Men comics and Professor Xavier's School for Gifted Children. I wanted to see what else was out there, beyond the valley where I grew up, meet different people. Perhaps that was shallow of me, but it's how I summoned the courage to leave my home and later take a job in Thailand. Meanwhile, Star Trek The Next Generation remains the single most compelling vision of the future that I know. The inhabitants of the Starship Enterprise have replicators and access to a sick bay, free housing and education and food and health care. They live without scarcity, money, or crime. They treat one another with respect, regardless of gender or ethnicity or sexual orientation. They're all equals. Transporters have erased distance, while universal translators have eliminated language barriers, making the sum knowledge of numerous societies available to all. As such, everybody is free to do whatever they want, whether it's study engineering or medicine or become an artist. What's more, this vision of the future is self-critical, committed to overcoming its own deficiencies, which is why later incarnations of Star Trek featured a black captain and a female captain. Star Trek's willingness to envision a better future is why it's appealed for so long to so many. I'm not embarrassed to admit I'd rather live in the world that Star Trek depicts, in terms of its morals and freedom from scarcity, than the world I currently live in. And that isn't just escapism, it's aspiration. Beam me up, Scotty. As a friend of mine once said, Star Trek is our religion. Exactly right. That's why I'm still passionate about the franchise and its characters, like Data and Picard, who embody its principles and serve as role models, made up though they may be. And that's why I hate it, the past three Star Trek films, and felt so betrayed by them. It wasn't because they featured different actors or different Enterprise set designs. It was because the moral values that I associate with Star Trek were discarded. For similar reasons, I walked into Logan not only feeling hopeful, but with a great sense of trepidation. I wasn't just looking to be entertained. I was looking to see a great film, one that respected the investments I've made in that character and his world. Even as an adult, I retain a strong sentimental attraction to Wolverine, a loner whose gruff exterior hides his lack of self-worth. That struck a nerve with me as a kid. If nothing else, Logan provided me with a chance for self-reflection. I can't watch the film without remembering my past. But for non-geeks, it's just a movie. Cool or not cool, good or bad. They either like it or they don't. And then they go on to something else. I understand that. When the Chicago Cubs won the World Series in October 2016, it didn't mean much to me, because although I live in Chicago, I am not and never have been a Cubs fan. But I have friends who were overjoyed because they've been Cubs fans since they were children and have spent their lives rooting for the team. This seems very healthy to me, not to mention very human. I understood why they were happy and didn't insult them as stunted degenerates who couldn't handle adult world responsibilities. Okay, I did, but only a little and all in good fun. No less an adult than Barack Obama, when asked by Rolling Stone about the contents of his iPod, confessed that its 2,000 songs were more heavily weighted toward the music of my childhood than toward new stuff. A lot of Stevie Wonder, a lot of Bob Dylan, a lot of Rolling Stones, a lot of R&B, a lot of Miles Davis and John Coltrane. Obama even admitted that music served, while he was president, as a welcome means of escape. Music is still a great source of joy and occasional solace in the midst of what can be some difficult days. My parents still listen to the Beatles and the Beach Boys, music that they enjoyed when young. Indeed, they sometimes still listen to the same vinyl LPs my mother bought as a teen. This isn't uncommon. The Rolling Stones are still on tour, and plenty of baby boomers are happy to tell you how much better things were back in the days of their youth. In Steven Soderbergh's 1999 movie The Limey, Peter Fonda's character, Terry Valentine, describes the 60s to his much younger lover in terms that geeks can readily understand, comparing that decade to a dream of a faraway place that maybe only exists in your imagination. Upon waking up, you can't entirely remember what you saw, the lay of the land, but when you were there, though, you knew the language. You knew your way around. Reading Peter Biskin's Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, I'm often touched by how much his book resembles Terry Valentine's speech, expressing Biskin's own dream of returning to a glorious time now lost. So, maybe escapism has its place. But to caricature geeks as dweebs who want nothing more than to run away from reality is to overlook geek culture's numerous political commitments. Scratch the surface of a geek artwork, and you'll find serious concerns. As it turns out, fantasy is still always about the real world. What else is there for art to be about? The resident New Yorker film critic Anthony Lane found Scott Pilgrim vs. the World underwhelming, no more than a skit, as you'll recall, padded out with visual fluff, but lacking depth or substance, its fights all painless panic, rendered in a zippy update on old Batman shows. Not a compliment. But his fellow critic, Richard Brody, disagreed, seeing the film as an exemplary portrait of the anxieties of today's middle-class, technologically connected teens. In his view, the movie represents how young people construct their senses of self from what they see in graphic novels and video games, then perform those selves on social media, which requires the constant maintenance of a self-aware guardedness. In this regard, Brody considers the film a modern update to the classic French New Wave movie Breathless, in which Jean-Luc Godard and Jean-Paul Belmondo portrayed how the youth of their generation modeled their behavior on movie stars. Brody concludes by declaring Scott Pilgrim vs. the World presents a richer blend of the contemporary adolescent experience than any teen comedy I've seen. I agree. Even big, dumb summer blockbusters like Avengers Age of Ultron are still about the real world after a fashion. I'll admit, I didn't think the movie great, nor did most geeks. But even when watching a mediocre action film, there's no real getting away from real life. When the Hulk kicks and punches a robot, actually robots, isn't the underlying motivation behind the scene an anxiety over modernity made manifest? The Hulk, like Godzilla, is a byproduct of the nuclear age, and he reflects, by way of Robert Louis Stevenson's Mr. Hyde, our deep-seated fears about nuclear warfare and radiation. Not for nothing do his fellow Avengers describe him as an out-of-control rage monster. Ultron, meanwhile, is the latest in a long line of automata, dating back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein's monster, if not further, that wriggle free from human control to run amok. When we watch those two grotesqueries fight, we're watching our id slug it out with our ego, both having been weaponized by the Industrial Revolution. The fact that Avengers Age of Ultron isn't a particularly good artwork, that it doesn't tell as good a story as Frankenstein or The Terminator, reflects badly on its creators, to be sure, but its badness isn't due to its not being about something real. The same year that Age of Ultron came out, Simon Pegg starred in The World's End, a movie about a grown-up yet out-of-control alcoholic who winds up battling not one, not two, but a whole horde of evil robots. They're also alien invaders. Take that, Hulk. Pegg swore to Radio Times that he planned to retire from geekdom, to go off and do some serious acting. But The World's End is deeply moving, a powerful portrait of alcoholism and the way aging tests one's friendships. It would be terrible if Pegg did not consider his acting in it serious. If anything, I don't think we take geek culture seriously enough. Being too quick to dismiss its artworks as stupid and frivolous instead of taking the time to read them, to try interpreting them before we criticize them. Part of the problem is that many people, especially older people, remain allergic to geekdom, still holding the prejudices they associate with nerds. This seems especially true of prestige critics who, in their desire to not be perceived as geeks themselves, staunchly protest that they don't understand a lick of the geeky movies they're watching, popular fare that the culture is forcing them to view. Geeks signal to one another that they're members of the same club, initiates of the same secret guild. Prestige critics do the opposite. They signal to their readers that they have nothing to do with that guild or with the geeks. To them, being able to distinguish Wolverine from his nemesis Sabretooth, or even Star Wars from Star Trek, is a point of pride, which is what leads so many to claim that superhero movies both make sense only to comic book fans and lack any complexity or nuance. A difficult circle to square. This bias persists because geek culture was once underground, alternative, part of its own counterculture that's right now in the process of going mainstream. And like all countercultures, alienation incarnate, geek culture embodies a particular set of politics. Geeks tend to be secular, as well as pro-science and pro-technology, and they like artworks that endorse those values. Geeks think of artworks as places to speculate about technologies and social structures, ways of living that today are only imaginary. That's why the geek blog IO9 publishes articles on geek artworks side by side with reports on scientific discoveries and technological advancements. The editors, writers, and readers of IO9 don't distinguish between the two. Visiting IO9 recently, I came across posts about the novels of the Star Wars Expanded Universe, Elon Musk's ongoing plans to send humans to Mars, and an article about costumes on Game of Thrones. As the site's tagline puts it, "We come from the future." In this way, geek culture retains its origin in philosophy and science, and the practice of using artworks as thought experiments, the means for modeling outcomes. Utopian artworks like Star Trek model our aspirations by projecting a better world, while dystopian artworks like Blade Runner and The Terminator model our fears. By projecting alternate visions of what could be, geeks are trying to come to grips with the present moment and where it might lead. I've already laid out why I think Star Trek is pretty much the greatest thing ever, at least when it comes to proposing a vision of the future. But obviously, Star Trek is also very much concerned with the here and now, as are most geek artworks. Only someone unfamiliar with geek culture could accuse it of being indifferent to politics and moral struggles. Instead, geeks have long used their hobbies to express their views on such issues. Cosplayers, for instance, routinely assert their right to dress up as whatever characters they admire, regardless of ethnicity and sex. And creators of fan fiction and fan art have long made slash works that depict characters of the same sex, say Kirk and Spock, in romantic, even erotic entanglements. Today, one favorite pairing is Stucky, which pairs Captain America with his childhood best friend, Bucky, who grew up to become the Winter Soldier. This led to a fan campaign hashtag Give Captain America a Boyfriend, requesting that Marvel officially make Captain America bisexual. On June 4th, 2016, a cosplayer who goes by The Roaring Girl Cosplay posted to her Tumblr account an image taken at a convention of her playing as Captain America while kissing a fellow cosplayer who's dressed as the Winter Soldier. Behind the pair stand Chris Evans and Sebastian Stan, the actors who officially portray Cap and Bucky in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Underneath the photograph, The Roaring Girl Cosplay wrote, "They thought we were fabulous. Hashtag give Captain America a boyfriend." Later, she edited the post to add, "They were totally cool with it. Seb said, ah, ha, 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 nice. And Chris started giggling. The guy behind us said they high-fived after we left." This kind of political advocacy can be found throughout geek culture, becoming both more common and more visible as geek culture becomes more mainstream. Many geeks oppose gender discrimination, criticizing, say, how it's taken Wonder Woman 70 years to get her own movie, or how slow Marvel has been to make a superhero film with a female lead, or that there are so few female directors, or that franchise toy lines often omit female characters, resulting in a dearth of Black Widow merchandise, for example, or Rey merchandise. In the case of Star Wars, the most common female action figure, at times the only such action figure, has been Slave Leia, a depiction of Leia's capture by Jabba the Hutt in Return of the Jedi, where he forces her to wear her notorious golden bikini. Toy companies claim that's the only female action figure that sells, because their customers are all boys. Similarly, Hollywood studios have claimed that people don't want to watch action movies with female leads. But geeks have never been ones to accept the way things have been for the way things have to be. The prestige critics want artworks depicting the world the way it is. They regard anything other than that as apolitical distraction. But geeks want artworks depicting the world the way it could be, which means their conflict isn't over whether art should be political. Both sides agree that it should. They both think art instrumental. Instead, their disagreement is merely over tactics. Which works better, depicting what is or what might be? I have to confess, I don't really know. Maybe both ways are perfectly fine. It's nice having choices. What's more, the geek approach only makes sense and only works if one understands how things currently are. How else could one tell that the artwork's depicting something different? So if you ask me, I don't think there's any real disagreement between the two sides, and that the critics and the geeks should kiss and make up. What a beautiful note to end on. But as it happens, we're still not done, because art is more than politics by other means. Art is art, with values all its own, and a politics all its own. To understand the meaning of that, and the significance of that, we must examine art on its own terms, taking it seriously as art, which involves reading it and interpreting it, trying to figure out what the people who made it are up to. So in the final chapter, let's do precisely that. Let's take a closer look at geek art, asking whether it's any good for anything other than escapism. 10. Back out in space again. The beauty of Star Wars. In 1997, Roger Ebert reviewed the crime thriller Freeway, which stars Reese Witherspoon and Kiefer Sutherland. He loved the film, which he described as a retelling of a grim fairy tale in a world of poor white trash, sexual abuse, drug addiction, and the I-5 killer, who prowls the freeways in search of victims. That's Kiefer Sutherland's character, in case you couldn't guess. Then, knowing that some of his readers wouldn't believe that the movie was actually good purely due to its subject matter, Ebert warded off their complaints about his celebrating such trash by formulating Ebert's Law, which reads, "A movie is not about what it is about. It is about how it is about it." Ebert was right. In order to understand and objectively analyze a film, or any artwork, one needs to examine what the filmmaker is saying about the subject matter, not the content. That's why the measure of an artwork is more than just content. It's subject matter and can never be reduced to how closely the artwork resembles the real world. Realism is merely a means to an end, and only one way of making art. Artworks can be realist or non-realist, dramatic or comedic, sincere or ironic, figurative or abstract, as well as different combinations of those approaches. Put another way, artworks are more than just mirrors held up to the world. Through them, artists respond to the real world, yes, but they respond also to other artworks. That's why learning to read an artwork, to interpret it and evaluate it, requires study and practice. Learning how to untangle the web of illusions, of conventions and associations through which artists encode and transmit meaning. Whatever else it happens to be, an artwork is also always a text, a representation of the world after a fashion, but never the world itself. As the philosopher Alfred Korzybski famously put it, the map is not the territory. No artwork, not even a realist one, is any closer to the real world than any other. Instead, all artworks are equally close and equally distant, being entirely artificial. Of course, some desire to pretend otherwise, aspiring to make the map and the territory one, and artworks synonymous with the world. Peter Biskind regards the New Hollywood not only as direct documentation of the counterculture, but as being part of the counterculture, the two inextricably bound up with each other. His view is ultimately a romantic one, I think, in which the movies made by the New Hollywood served as the counterculture's soul. As long as the counterculture was healthy, its soul was healthy, and the movies turned out good. But when the counterculture floundered, then failed, its soul sickened, and the movies went all to pieces. That's why Biskind has so little regard for the later New Hollywood films, megabuck flops like Martin Scorsese's New York, New York, Steven Spielberg's 1941, Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate, Paul Schrader's Cat People, William Friedkin's Sorcerer and Cruising, and Francis Ford Coppola's One from the Heart, all of which he decries as decadent works made by men who'd lost touch with the muse, with the activity on the ground. After those failures came The Dark Time, the reign of the Emperor, Ronald Reagan, during which the New Hollywood directors went into exile from the studios, and few, if any, good pictures were made. How could one make them? The counterculture had been lost. If the movies got good again, then that would mean the culture was healthy once again, and vice versa. It's like the White Tree of Gondor. But that's impossible now, because sellouts like Lucas and Spielberg poisoned the soil, leaving the truer artists, Scorsese and Altman and Friedkin, bereft, doomed to wander homeless in an era of corporate franchises, in a land of unchecked corruption and consumption. Geeks also wish to transform art into reality, but for reasons other than Biskind's. We've already seen their own unique romantic urges, their fierce desire to have art not be art, but foreign lands that they can enter and therein lose themselves and experience the sublime. To that end, they want art to document some stable other world. In March 1990, members of the rec.arts.comics newsgroup fell to discussing the quote, "Metropolis is New York City by day, Gotham City is New York City by night." Its source is unknown. One user chimed in to complain about how different artists at different times have portrayed those two different cities in different ways, that some have set them across a bay from each other, while others have located them elsewhere, sometimes a continent apart. As a result, there are more than enough references to place them just about anywhere along the northern half of the East Coast, if not somewhere inland. For instance, John Byrne located Metropolis in the Midwest. The user then concludes that it would be nice if DC actually came out with a definitive map of the DC universe and would then stick to it. This is the geek desire par excellence. Of course, Metropolis and Gotham are fictional cities, and as such, don't have to be portrayed any single way or represent any single thing. They are instead open-ended means for representing whatever it is artists want to represent. Whoever said that Metropolis is New York City by day and Gotham New York City by night understood that and was making a metaphorical point. And a metaphor can't be mapped, not in any conventional way. That discrepancy troubles the geek mindset with its preference for realism. Representations, which include metaphors and allegories and other types of meaning, undermine the illusion that Gotham City is a real place, somewhere out there. The geeks don't want Gotham City to mean multiple things. The geeks don't want Gotham City to mean anything. Instead, the geeks want Gotham City to function the same way that real cities do. Real cities don't represent, either metaphorically or in any other way. Rather, real cities simply are. New York City is New York City. Nothing more and nothing less. The geeks want Gotham City, similarly, to be only Gotham City, and not look as though it's representing another thing. To that end, they want a definitive map that identifies where Gotham City is and where Metropolis is in relationship to that. An extra artistic model set down in stone, a frozen past that later artists should inherit and be forced to abide by, recreating that layout on every page, in every frame, in every scene. This way of thinking and working is fine if one is making, say, a TV show or a comic book miniseries, which requires consistency across episodes, unity inside the artwork's boundaries, between its beginning and its end. But it isn't fine if one is proposing that this apply to all artworks made with a given character or premise, because what's lost with that approach is the ability of later artists to use Gotham City in their own ways, to tell different stories about that imaginary place. In making his classic graphic novel, Batman: The Dark Knight Returns, Frank Miller devised the Gotham City that he needed, a realist city that looked a lot like NYC, caught in the grip of a killer heat wave. He gave it twin towers for Harvey Dent, Two-Face, to attack. He gave it an amusement park for the Joker to terrorize. He gave it the places and features he needed to tell the story he wanted to tell, which in many ways continued his work on Daredevil, and put his work in conversation with vigilante films like Dirty Harry, Death Wish, and Taxi Driver. Soon after that, Tim Burton revised Gotham City to make his desired films, as did Joel Schumacher after that, and then Christopher Nolan. That's how it should be. Artists should always be free to rework characters and other fictional concepts. Of course, new Batman artists are obliged to engage with the character's long history and the city the man calls home, but they are also free to act against that history, which is, to a large extent, already contradictory. Some of those artists might choose to tell realist stories. Others might choose to take less realist approaches, preferring expressionism and caricature. And others might combine realism and non-realism. But being able to choose Gotham's placement and appearance is essential. More is at stake than artistic freedom. Franchises and long-running serial artworks must remain open-ended and malleable to survive, lest obsessive obedience to the past make them inaccessible to newer audiences, due to the homework problem, as well as the danger of becoming stale, old-fashioned, out of date. Just imagine if DC Comics had decided back in the 1940s that Bob Kane and Bill Finger's approach to Batman was gospel, and that all artists after them had to slavishly write and draw the strip the same way those two men had. It's hard to believe there'd be any Batman fans around today. Being wholly imaginary, fictional characters neither live nor die, nor do their cities ever crumble into ruin. The only demise that fictions face is if people lose interest in them and forget them. In this regard, characters are like concepts, not unlike democracy and free will, intangible things one can't discover in the real world, not directly. Instead, they're principles that we've devised and then embodied, enshrined in institutions like government, schools, the law. Such concepts always remain works in progress. We keep refining them, redefining them, according to the spirit of the times. Characters work in much the same way. Consider Luke Skywalker. Lucas created him so that Star Wars would have a hero. In the first film, Luke is a wide-eyed youngster dreaming of escape from his home planet, the remote desert world of Tatooine. He has courage and skill as a pilot, but he's also naive and impulsive, driven by his emotions. He falls under the tutelage of Jedi Master Obi-Wan Kenobi and, as the older man says, thereby takes his first step into a larger world. By the movie's end, he's managed to trust his feelings and use the Force to blow up the Empire's Death Star, becoming a hero of the rebellion. Along the way, he makes friends, finding a big brother in Han Solo and a love interest in Princess Leia. Yes, a love interest. It's clear from Star Wars that Lucas intended Luke and Han to be rivals for Leia's affections. In Skywalking, Lucas's biographer Dale Pollack quotes his subject as saying in regard to the three heroes, "It was the classic triangle plot. One good guy, one bad guy, who's the girl attracted to?" And when Harrison Ford demanded that Han Solo be further developed in The Empire Strikes Back, Lucas decided that fit his plan to duplicate the love triangle in Gone with the Wind. Han is Rhett Butler, Leia is Scarlett O'Hara, and Luke is Ashley Wilkes. It has to be a real triangle, with real emotions, and at the same time, it has to end up with goodwill, Lucas said. As Star Wars was nearing its completion, Lucas hired Alan Dean Foster, who had ghostwritten the Star Wars novelization, to write a sequel, Splinter of the Mind's Eye. Remember, Lucas was worried that Star Wars would be a flop and figured the novel could form the basis for a cheaper follow-up film to help recoup losses. Splinter is thus a much simpler affair. Luke and Leia crash land on a jungle planet where they get caught up in a race against Darth Vader for the Kyber Crystal, a mystical gem capable of amplifying Force powers. Setting the tale in a single environment was a means of keeping costs down. Plus, Lucas seems to be fond of jungles. Luke and Leia appear because Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher were contractually obligated for two sequels. Han is AWOL because Harrison Ford had signed on for only a single film. Splinter of the Mind's Eye is not a particularly good novel, but it remains interesting today because it reveals an alternative path for Star Wars. What might have been? Luke spends a fair amount of the story lusting after Leia. As early as page 3, we're reading about how, whenever he looked at her, the other, that's Leia, caused emotions to boil within him, like a soup too long on the fire, no matter if she was separated by near vacuum, as at present, or by only an arm's length in a conference room. It's not clear how Luke looks at Leia across the near vacuum of space. He uses the Force. Throughout, Luke is riddled with anxiety as to whether the aloof princess might reciprocate his feelings, given he's just a simple farm boy. Clearly, Lucas hadn't decided yet that Luke and Leia were brother and sister, and the Luke-Leia-Han love triangle would persist to The Empire Strikes Back. There is also no evidence in Splinter that Darth Vader is related to Leia or Luke, Lucas not deciding on the I am your father business until he made Empire. This is how characters develop, sometimes with as many false steps and dead ends as there are strides forward. Lucas didn't fully figure out who Luke Skywalker was until he made Return of the Jedi, All's Well That Ends Well. And now that the Jedi Master is appearing in a new trilogy of films, the time has come for others to figure out what remains to be done with the fellow. Indeed, J.J. Abrams has claimed that Lucasfilm president Kathleen Kennedy convinced him to write and direct The Force Awakens by asking him, "Who is Luke Skywalker?" As long as they appear in artworks, characters remain works in progress, necessarily so. Like philosophical concepts, how they develop and what they go on to be have to make sense in relation to the past. One can't throw out the values comprising democracy and start over. In the same way, an artist can't remake Princess Leia as a wisecracking robot determined to eat all the chocolate in the world, or transform Wolverine into an alien graffiti artist who dreams of someday owning a gold-plated pair of dentures. Well, they could, but they'd probably confuse and alienate people. There are core features defining any popular character that it would be difficult for any artist to jettison. Batman originally used a gun, until someone decided that the character should eschew such weaponry, since his parents were murdered with one. That change made sense. It made Batman better, more refined. So when Zack Snyder had Batman use guns in Batman v. Superman, Dawn of Justice, his creative decision didn't make logical sense and didn't move the character forward. But that isn't to say that Batman can't change or can't use a gun, provided that use is justified. Rather, he's all change, so much so that over the years, he's split into incompatible versions, as often happens with concepts. He started out as a gentleman crime fighter, only to be forced by the Comics Code Authority to become more cartoonish, the kid-friendly caped crusader, head of the Bat family, which included a costumed dog, because dogs were popular in the 1950s thanks to Lassie. That take on Batman culminated in Adam West's bat-suing television portrayal, The Campy Batman, which fit the spirit of the zany and irreverent mid to late 60s. The following decade saw a renewed emphasis on gothic elements and detective work, resulting in Dennis O'Neill and Neil Adams' Batman, which influenced Tim Burton and the 1990s cartoons. Around the same time, in the mid-1980s, Frank Miller created the brooding Dark Knight, which was evolved by Christopher Nolan. That version of Batman is dominant now, and Zack Snyder and Ben Affleck didn't stray too far from it when making Batman v Superman. But the grimmer, grittier, darker Batman hasn't eliminated the more gothic Batman, or even the campy, silly Batman, who resurfaced briefly in Joel Schumacher's two 1990s films. And who can say, maybe in 10 years' time, people will grow bored of Batman being so grim and so dark, and will yearn for a lighter take on the character. There are already signs that might be the case. Will Arnett's Lego Movie Batman gently parodies Christian Bale's grittier, gravel-voiced performance. Darkness. No parents. Continued darkness. More darkness. Or maybe a new variation on Batman will emerge. As always, creators and fans will embrace what they think best, rejecting the rest. To insist on one version of Batman, solely a realist one, would mean to lose all of that, and whatever may come. Of course, having multiple versions of Batman in Gotham City reveals the inherent artifice of them all. Perhaps that would trouble Peter Biskind. For him, any sign of contrivance weakens an artwork, makes it less authentic, less genuine, less expressive. For geeks, signs of artifice also ruin the artwork. They ruin the fantasy, make them remember they're looking at art, not a foreign place. But whatever it is that Biskind wants, and whatever it is that geeks want, art is artifice, through and through. It is contrivance, all the way down. That is why contrivance and artifice aren't, in the end, enemies of art. Even realism, in which the artist labors to conceal his or her hand, remains contrivance. Realism is just another way of doing artifice. Artifice and contrivance are, in fact, the foundations of art, its basis, as are formula and conventions. To love art as art means to love those things, because that's all art ever is, something artificial that someone made. Rather than being a limitation, artifice is the nature of art, which isn't weakened by how it differs from the world. Instead, its differences from the world define what art is. In the case of film, each shot is only ever so big, the frame leaving out much more than it lets in. A shot is also only so long, having a beginning and an end. Art's always bounded. Those restrictions are the basis of film artistry. Citizen Kane would not be better if its images were expanded, taking in more of the title character's surroundings, nor would it be better if they were in color or in 3D. And it wouldn't be better if viewers could hijack the camera and move it around, left or right, up or down, choosing to see different angles, different points of view, different scenes. Nor would it be better if we could wander Kane's mansion, Xanadu, smelling its smells, sitting down beside visitors and sharing with them meals and conversations, feeding the unruly cockatoo, or assisting Susan with her many jigsaw puzzles. Citizen Kane is defined by the restrictions of each shot. It is composed of what those shots exclude in addition to what they admit, as well as the order in which they were placed. Each shot, each composition, each edit is the result of a series of choices, and the movie called Citizen Kane is the sum of those choices, the sum of those shots. To love Citizen Kane is to love precisely that. And to love art is to love its limits, its boundaries, which are the nature of the medium itself. It's to love the thing the artist made given those constraints, and to wonder why he or she made it that way, why Wells chose to place the camera here and to cut there, to wonder why he joined this strip of film to that one in that way. To love an art form is to wonder what other artists have done given the same materials, the same medium, regardless of subject matter. To love art is to love the medium, which is never life itself, but something smaller, a stage representing a field in England instead of an actual field in England. The beauty of art is finite. It is the beauty of the frame and how the artist worked inside it, employing their given set of materials and organizing the whole. If one is truly devoted to art, then one wants to study these things, know these things. But if one is devoted to geekdom, then one might not want to study them, or the history of an art form, learning how artists do what they do. Knowing the practice, how the sausage gets made, so to speak, will reveal the artifice, making it harder to surrender to the spell. When I watch a movie, I see the cuts, because I have trained myself to see them. I can't not see them. I see each shot as a composition, observing its boundaries, like depth of field. I see the film as a production. I see its design, its organization. None of this ruins the movie for me, because I love seeing these things. I love film. But at the same time, none of this stops me from being a geek up to a point. While I like watching films from all different times and places, my favorite movies remain fantasy films. I still remember the awe I felt watching Return of the Jedi for the first time, and Tim Burton's Batman for the first time. My love for those movies led me to want to watch other films, to take film classes while at college, where I first read books about film history and film style. That led to my interest in film aesthetics, the different approaches that people could take to the medium. I started watching French New Wave films, surrealist films, classic Hollywood films, independent films, silent films, experimental films. I started attending film clubs and film festivals, then writing about films, which led to my teaching film and blogging about film, and eventually projects like this book. To recoil from artifice, to despise it, is to love something else, to want something else, something other than art. It is to want to live on the Starship Enterprise, rather than watch a Star Trek movie or TV show. The more one wants the movies and shows, the more one cares about what makes them good in relation to other movies and other shows. But the more one wants the Enterprise itself, the less one cares about the art. That person still watches the movies and shows, but only because they can't go live on the Enterprise. But if they could, they would no longer need the artworks. That's why so many geeks don't want there to be any boundaries, any limits in their art. They don't want the artwork, but what the artwork represents. And they don't want the artwork to ever end, because they don't want their experience of its subject to ever end. But art always ends. It has to. That's what makes it art. As for the artwork known as Star Wars, that touchstone of geekdom, its guiding star, what was it exactly? In the beginning, Lucas didn't set out to build another galaxy, a sandbox for other people to play in, nor did he set out to make a franchise that he would oversee and revise until he was old, nor did he set out to destroy the new Hollywood or to infantilize the culture. He wanted simply to make a film, complete in itself with a beginning, middle, and end, a single movie that would delight and enthrall those who saw it. Did Lucas succeed? Is Star Wars good? Or is it merely a means to a fantasy? Is it serious, even adult? Is it a work of art? What exactly did Lucas make? Let's find out. At its heart, Star Wars is a coming-of-age story. In this, it recalls Lucas's previous film, American Graffiti, which follows a group of teens as they spend a long night cruising around Petaluma, California in their cars. The start of Graffiti sees two of its male leads, Steve and Kurt, contemplating their futures. Steve is getting ready to leave for college, while Kurt is thinking of staying in town, despite having been offered a scholarship. In the end, the two men trade places, each one having changed his mind. Kurt leaves while Steve stays. The final title cards tell us that Kurt became a writer, while Steve wound up an insurance agent in Modesto, California, Lucas's hometown. Through this, Lucas was reflecting on his own decision to leave home to study film at USC. Already, becoming an artist is linked with leaving home. In Star Wars, Lucas created a different surrogate, whom he this time named after himself. Luke Skywalker is an orphan, working on his aunt and uncle's moisture farm, but yearning to travel elsewhere. Lucas was raised on a walnut ranch. Luke has talent as a pilot, but it's wasted on Tatooine, where the only fun to be had is hanging out at Toshi Station and shooting up womp rats in his speeder. The Star Wars equivalent of tinkering with cars and cruising while listening to rock and roll. That's how Lucas spent his teenage years, dreaming of becoming a race car driver. Fate intervenes, though, and Luke gets swept up in the larger current of history, leaving home with Ben Kenobi, a mysterious, mystical warrior. Under his tutelage, Luke learns the ways of the Jedi Knights, a lost order whose ranks include Ben and Luke's dead father. Together, they travel to a city, Mos Eisley, then to an even bigger city, the Death Star, which is the size of a small moon. Luke finds decadence and corruption in the former, soulless sterility in the latter. Lucas depicts these proceedings with a realism that he learned, like his colleagues in the New Hollywood, from the French New Wave, Italian neorealism, and cinema verite. But Star Wars still kept one foot planted in previous science fiction, the big message allegorical films of the late 1960s and early 70s, Planet of the Apes and Soylent Green, plus novels like Brave New World and 1984. Lucas had already responded to these works in his first feature, THX 1138, a portrait of a man who flees a society rendered docile by drugs, TV, and consumerism elevated to the level of religion. Lucas continued his allegorical storytelling in Star Wars, which tells how a lowly farmer rises up to take down an oppressive mechanical empire. Along the way, the farmer rejects his own dependence on technology. Only by switching off his computer does Luke manage to blow up the Death Star. Allegorical realism, then, or realist allegory. Lucas also threw in ideas he'd gleaned from German Expressionism. John Williams' score is highly expressive, assigning Wagnerian leitmotifs to the major characters. From Fritz Lang, Lucas borrowed the design of C-3PO, modeled on the robot in Metropolis, Maria. The look of the city planet of Coruscant in the prequel trilogy was also inspired by that film. More important, Lucas adopted the German Expressionist conceit of using landscapes to communicate information about the characters and the plot. Some geeks have decried the monobiome aspect of Star Wars, of the entire trilogy, calling it unrealistic for all the planets to be reduced to just one climate. But Lucas's interest here wasn't strictly realist, but blending expressionism with realism. The desert planet of Tatooine reflects and amplifies Luke's frustrations and his desire to get away. A child of the frontier, Luke yearns for the tempting city lights. But once he arrives on the Death Star, he finds the place cold and industrial, immiserating and intolerable. Aided by a ragtag band of companions, he winds up rejecting that metropolis, escaping and joining a rebellion headquartered in an Edenic jungle. Their temple home is tropical, lush, the exact opposite of where Luke started, and the New Hope of the movie's eventual subtitle. The Rebellion is Lucas's take on the counterculture. While researching and writing Star Wars, Lucas read Carlos Castaneda's 1974 book Tales of Power, an account of the Yaqui man of power, Don Juan Matas, who spoke of a life force. Matas became Obi-Wan Kenobi, and many of the wise sayings that Ben tells Luke are revised Castaneda. Early drafts of Star Wars also had characters searching for kyber crystals so they could harness the power of the Force, a bit of New Age mysticism. Those crystals resurfaced in Splinter of the Mind's Eye, then became the key component in Jedi lightsabers, and were recently resurrected as a plot point in Rogue One. In the end, the hippie-like rebellion triumphs because of its alliance with men like Kenobi, who passes his power on to Luke, his chosen heir. But the rebellion is more than just the counterculture. It's Lucas's metaphor for the new Hollywood itself. Many have observed that Han Solo was modeled on Francis Ford Coppola, the cocksure older brother whose fortunes rise and fall at the drop of a hat. Lucas met Coppola when Lucas was in his early 20s, roughly the same age that we find Luke. Han's a smuggler, eking out a living under the nose of the Empire, pursuing adventure by the seat of his pants. He always needs money to pay off some debt, and although he wins massive fortunes through gambling, he can never hold on to the prize. This is what keeps him in thrall to slimy crime lords like Jabba, gangsters who thrive under the Empire with their nightclubs and their dancers. Han Solo abandons this life to side with the good-hearted Luke and join the rebellion. In this view, the Empire stands in for Hollywood, a stifling enterprise always interfering with people, changing the terms of the deals that it makes. Lucas hated having his films cut, hated having to compromise his artistic vision. After Warner Brothers cut 4 minutes from THX 1138, Lucas refused to speak to the studio's chairman, Ted Ashley, for a decade. He was similarly outraged when Universal cut 4 minutes from American Graffiti, an experience that led him to vow he would never again surrender creative control on any of his pictures. That's why he refused to move to L.A., the corrupt big city, and instead insisted on producing his own films in San Francisco. He expressed his frustrations with Hollywood to Dale Pollack at the dawn of the 1980s. The studio system is dead. The power is with the people now. The workers control the means of production. That wasn't quite true, but Lucas wanted the same thing as Peter Biskind, for the counterculture-fueled new Hollywood to supplant the moribund studio system of the past. Lucas and Coppola dreamed of becoming successful, independent filmmakers and establishing an artist's commune in San Fran, American Zoetrope, Skywalker Ranch. What drove and enabled this dream was the Force, Lucas's metaphor for art, the thing one leaves home to pursue, an invigorating power with which one can oppose the soulless Empire. The Force surrounds us, but only a gifted few can sense it and grow attuned to it, becoming shamans, leaders. Fittingly, Ben Burtt created the sound of the Jedi's weapon, the lightsaber, by combining the sound of a movie projector with a television set. The tragedy of Darth Vader, then, is that he's a fellow artist after a fashion, but he was seduced and twisted long ago by Hollywood, the big city entertainment industry, having taken the quick and selfish path of easy reward, the path that leads only to the dark side. But Vader remembers the power of art and knows it's more powerful than the Death Star. At the end of Star Wars, when Luke destroys the Death Star, when Lucas blows up Hollywood, Darth Vader isn't killed, but is sent spiraling away, free to pursue his own fate. In making Star Wars, Lucas was doing more than indulging in his nostalgia for Flash Gordon. Like Luke, he was searching for something. You can see it if you look. He'd graduated from USC feeling ambivalent about Hollywood. On the one hand, he loved movies. On the other, he could see how hard it was to make art in Hollywood. But his dream of becoming an artist had taken him this far, had gotten him out of Modesto. He resigned himself to becoming an editor, or maybe making documentaries and small experimental films. The risk was becoming like Darth Vader, doomed to know what art was, but surrounded by an empire that didn't care. The generals Vader deals with are working stiffs who put all their trust in their machines and who speak of the Jedi, when they speak of them at all, as feeble sorcerers devoted to a religion whose fire has gone out of the universe. That fire is both the Force and art. Both animate life. In becoming a Jedi, Luke rekindles that fire. But the danger always remains of succumbing to the dark side, of becoming the Empire's next servant. Star Wars was Lucas's means of remaining independent, of making a movie he wanted to see. It's a deeply personal picture, combining his autobiography with elements taken from all the older movies he loved, the films that inspired him to become a movie director. Hollywood and the film industry as a whole was a soulless machine, wicked and corrupt, in love with making money, not art. But it had managed, nonetheless, to produce some great movies, which Lucas had absorbed while at USC. Besides Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers, besides Metropolis, Star Wars alludes to Alphaville, Forbidden Planet, The Hidden Fortress, The Searchers, Triumph of the Will, and Yojimbo, plus World War II fighter pilot films and Arthur Lipsett's obscure 1964 experimental short, 2187, which was another source for the term, the Force. Lucas synthesized those disparate influences into a single, fantastical epic, a testament to film artistry. When Star Wars took off, becoming a runaway hit, a financial juggernaut, Lucas tried to harness its energy, its fire. He wanted to use its profits to create his own jungle temple, a private film studio, Skywalker Ranch, an alternative to Hollywood, a lush and verdant place outside the city. There, on the outskirts, he'd retain full control, offering the other new Hollywood artists a place to work, a safe haven from the Empire. One can doubt whether Lucas succeeded in this task, whether he didn't become a slave to his own creation, which over time even he began to second-guess and tinker with. The fire dimmed, went out. But there can be no doubt that Star Wars, the original Star Wars, wholly succeeded. It's Lucas's portrait not just of himself, but of his ambitions and the new Hollywood's ambitions. It is a portrait of the new Hollywood itself. That old, lost order was never exclusively devoted to realism. Rather, those actors and writers and directors fought to get out from under studio contracts and censorship, to make their way in the world at large, where they could make whatever pictures they wanted to make. So too did Lucas. By synthesizing realism and expressionism, pop culture and counterculture, the avant-garde and the geeky, he made a film embodying their commitment to art as rebellion, an iconoclastic force. The new Hollywood's masterpiece, George Lucas's masterpiece, Star Wars, is a movie about freedom. This is Halter Graham. We hope you've enjoyed I Find Your Lack of Faith Disturbing, a Macmillan audio production from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2018 by A.D. Jameson. Production copyright 2018 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.